So this is the first, can everyone hear me? So this is the first day of this four-day retreat here in end of January 2015 at the Franciscan Center. And the topic, or what this retreat was labeled, The Path to Wholeness, Mindfulness, Deep Looking, Joyful Effort, and a Unified Mind. Those of you who have been around the past year know that in our intensives, in our retreats, in our Dharma talks, in the various sanghas, really for almost a year now, we have been looking at these fundamental teachings, the seven factors of awakening, of which mindfulness, deep looking, joyful effort, and concentration, or what I'm calling a unified mind, are the first four. Joy, ease, and equanimity are the next three. But I assure you that if you are practicing the first four, you will experience the last three. For this retreat, mindfulness is that capacity to know, to recollect, to remember where you are, and when you're not where you are, to recognize that you're not where you are, and so you're able to return to where you want to be. That is all a faculty of mind that is in mindfulness. It is said in the meditative tradition that we have to place mindfulness at the gate of our minds. And of course, those who've been around have heard me say that ad nauseum. But if there is not a gatekeeper, if there is some faculty of mind that is attending to what is arising within the mind, if there is not some faculty of mind that can recognize where one is and whether that is where one should be, we are lost. What are we lost to? We're lost to our habit energies. We're lost to the way we've always done things. We've lost to the stream of our own consciousness filled with all our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions which we have acquired since endless time, and they will just continue to play out the way they always have. So if we want to change, if there is something inside us that says, there is more than what I experience, that the way I feel, the way I relate, the way I experience, the way I think, the way I perceive, there is something distorted because it does not produce within me a ongoing sense of ease, well-being, happiness, openness, right? So if we have encountered her teachings, understand that we are all capable of that, then if we are going to change, there has to be a gatekeeper. Mindfulness is the gatekeeper. Right. And our teachings have given us the criteria of what is to be nurtured and what is to be let go of. What is to be let in and what is to be rejected, or if it does get in, to speedily get out. And you know, at a recent Dharma talk, since we do live in Florida, many of us, we all know about gated communities, and we do know that the essence of a gated community is what? A gate. and there's somebody at the gate. There's a gatekeeper, and he or she has criteria about who's let in and who is not let in. Right? If we do not have a gatekeeper on our mind, everybody and anybody can get in anytime they want. There has to be a gatekeeper. As well as in a really secure gated community, they not only have somebody at the gate, but they also have a security who drives around, you know, right? Just in case. So while it is best to have a gatekeeper, all that delusive stuff doesn't get in, we also have to be aware of what's going on inside us. So if stuff has already gotten in, we can deal with it. Is that clear? So for this retreat, please erect mindfulness at the gate, which is mean there is a quality of self-awareness that you are aware of what is arising in your mind. You are aware of what thoughts are arising, what feelings are arising, how you are perceiving things. There is an awareness of how you're relating to things. And that mindfulness, combined with the teachings that you have received, will cue you to whether this is something to be nurtured or this is something to be let go of. This is something to let in, or is this something to shut the door on? Everybody here has that capacity. If you say, oh, it's so hard, it's not so hard. It is hard because we have not developed that capacity. It's as simple as that. When you've developed the capacity, it's easy. When you haven't developed the capacity, it's hard. So it is more about developing capacity, competence. And you only do that by how? By doing it over and over and over again. Right? If you do it for a few minutes and then you go, oh God, my, I'm terrible at this. And then you go off on one of your, internal rants about how terrible you are, or hard it is, or you will never get anywhere. You just have to be very persistent. And you can develop this. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect. And you don't have to be perfect. But you have to make an effort and you have to do your best or it will not happen. What I'm calling a unified mind is concentration, which means in our meditation, in our eating, we are concentrated. We are focused. The mind is unified on whatever activity is involved. And that is another a capacity of the mind that produces what might be called the enlightened mind. And deep looking below the surface, looking at causation, looking at where things are coming from, looking at what things are composed of, looking at the things to see whether they're real, solid, self-existent or not. This is all involved in deep looking. As you've heard me say before, mindfulness and concentration will not liberate you. I castigated Chris yesterday. In the old days, the then teachers had sticks. Might have been more effective, but I've taken away the sticks, so all we can use is our words. But yesterday I castigated Chris because he said, or this morning even, I castigated yesterday about something else. That's right. I can't keep up with it. Well, Chris hasn't been in retreat a while, so he needs a lot of castigating. Because he said his goal of retreat was to be in the present moment. Well, I said, that is certainly laudable. That will not liberate you from your sufferings, because your sufferings are deeply embedded in your mind. They are reinforced by a self that believes all these things are real and true and lives by them. And, you know, all you will be when you live in the present moment is a deluded person living in the present moment. Which, again, is a step up. I mean, I'm not putting that down, right? But it stops things when we are present in that way of just being present in a mindful, concentrated way. That in itself, in that experience, we may not be suffering and may feel good, right? But our conditioning is still active within our unconscious, and it will continue to be activated. This was the experience of the Buddha himself. This is not I'm making this up. I mean, the Buddha himself, when he was in his own spiritual journey before he came to his own enlightenment, when he visited all the great masters, they were teaching trance, they were teaching concentration, they were teaching mindfulness. And what the Buddha realized was all these kinds of trance states, all they did, or all these kinds of states created, was a temporary suspension, but it wasn't liberation. And so for liberation, there has to be this deep looking, this understanding. It is our insight, is it our understanding of the way things are, that we become liberated. And the fourth watchword of our retreat is joyful effort. I happened to stumble into a group discussion yesterday, and I stumbled into it in the middle, so I'm not sure what preceded. But I did hear some strange things. Again, because I am on my best behavior, and because I was a guest at the meeting, I remained silent. But people do say funny things, such as, oh, this practice of letting go of views, of letting go of attachments, of letting go of ego and self. This is not easy, is it? This is difficult, right? I totally disagree. Living the life of ego, living the life of self, and all its issues, and all its sufferings, and all its difficulties, right? Living the life of anger and resentment and hurt and disappointment and fear and anxiety, and, you know, resentments and loss and attachment, you know, that's a difficult life. That's a hard life. Suffering is hard. Ease, letting go, is easy. I don't know how it got twisted that people think that practicing this path is hard, is difficult. Holding on is hard. Letting go is easy. Tell me that I'm missing something. I mean, do you see how out of whack we are? And people who say this are good people. These are good, intelligent people. But somehow we don't see clearly how topsy-turvy our thinking is. In Buddhism, there's a term. This mind is called topsy-turvy thinking. It's upside down. What is easy, it sees hard. What is hard, it thinks, you know, is easy. Right? Does anybody want to challenge me on that? I am totally open to being challenged on that. I'm serious. Yes, Alex. the prime.
I thought it would take longer for you to castigate me.
Oh no, no, I. Oh, hold on, I'm not done yet. But go on.
Speaking for those who are on this and this developmental model that we have been working with this Buddhist path, I think that because of our causes and conditions and the world that we live in, because we learn from such an early age, the conditioning that becomes very powerful, that I would challenge you as to
good.
That being easy.
You were the one who said, were you talking about hardwiring yesterday?
It sounds like me.
Oh. So let me continue on, Dr. Lerner. The first patriarch of Zen, Bodhidharma. He sat in a cave, I say, for 6-9 years. When his disciple, wasn't his disciple yet, Wiko, came to the cave to be taught, Bodhidharma ignored him, just continued to meditate. It is said that all night it snowed, and Wiko stayed outside freezing in the snow. Still, Bodhidharma would not teach him. Finally, it is said, Wiko cut off his arm and offered it to him to say, look, I am serious. I'll even cut off my arm. And then let me try to remember. I actually have a Zen book, so maybe I'll look it up. But it was a... So Bodhidharma realized at that moment, and again, these are apocryphal kind of stories, realized, oh, this is somebody who really wants my Dharma. And so he said to him, what is it, you know, what is it that you want from me? What can I do for you? And I'll look it up, but I mean, it's been a while, but I think Wiko said something, you know, Master, please free me from this agitated, suffering mind of mine. And Bodhidharma said, right now, show me this suffering mind of yours. And Bodhidharma and Wiko looked into his mind. There was nothing there. And so Wiko said, I can't find it. And Bodhidharma said, see, you are now liberated from your suffering mind. Show me your conditioning. Show me your conditioning. Why can you not show it? You're a bright man. Why can you not show it? It's so powerful. It's so powerful. So hardwired into you. And yet when you look for it, you cannot see it. What does that tell you?
It tells me what it's always told me from the teachings, that it's self-created.
Then if it's self-created, it can be self-destroyed. And all you need to do is look. This is not so hard. It just takes a willingness to look directly at what you think is solid and real. When you look at it, I assure you, you will see there is nothing there. But you have to stop and look. That's the practice. Mindfulness, stopping, deep looking. And you know, it will reveal itself to you. We can go on and on and on about the self, but if somebody says to you, can you show me yourself, this self of yours, and you look in your mind for it, you will not find anything called the self. At that moment, you are liberated from yourself. Right? Unfortunately, 2 minutes later, you're going to be back there again. And you have to look again. And you have to look again. And you have to look again. If you keep looking over time, it'll become more and more apparent to you. It is not that your conditioning is so powerful. It's because your identification with your conditioning and the self that is attached to it is so strong. That's what needs to be loosened. It's important we understand that. There was somebody, probably you, who said something about hardwiring. You love that hardwiring. We turn our minds into computers. Do you know what Buddhism teaches, Alex? That we are hardwired, using your terminology, to be Buddhists. We have been conditioned by causes and conditions, life situations, to find endless other reasons and purposes for life. But why are we here? You know, what is the proof? You know, if we are hardwired, right, for views and ideas and self, right, if that's really hardwired, then how did the Buddha, growing up in the lap of luxury and ease, where did that yearning for liberation come from? There was nothing in his conditioning to produce that. Why is Alex Lerner here? Why are we all here? If we look for the seeds of why we're here, we probably will not find them in our families of origin. We will not find them in our grammar school, in our middle school, in our high school, in our college, in our professions. So what is it? It is because we are hardwired by our true mind. That is our gift. As Bhante said, that is the gift of our parents. And yet, because of cause and conditions, we have turned our back on it. We have forgotten it. And we live this life of self. We live this life of delusion. We live this life of endless emotionality. But because our hardwiring is Buddha mind, all our conditioning we can change. How did the Buddha become a Buddha? How did Thich Nhat Hanh become Thich Nhat Hanh? How does anybody become? How's the Dalai Lama? Dalai Lama was born to nomads, right? You know, if he did not have within himself the seed of awakening, he wouldn't be such an influential person. Thich Nhat Hanh was born, I don't know, some village in Vietnam, right? At a young age, he went to a temple. You know, not an illustrious temple, not with an illustrious teacher. What is it? Where does his wisdom come from? From his hard wiring that he is tapped into. He is tapped into the same hard wiring that all the Buddhas and all the teachers and all the awakened ones have tapped into. It is indestructible. It is important. Actually, in this intensive, I want to... the teachings I'm going to be sharing come from the Zen tradition. The Zen tradition, like the Great Perfection tradition, are very radical. We have to understand that. They say, we are all Buddhas, as Hakuin Zenji, great Zen teacher, said. From the beginning, all beings are Buddha. Like water and ice. Without water, no ice. And As my first teacher, Philip Kaplow, used to say, that is the only article of faith in Buddhism. We don't have to believe that the Buddha was the Son of God. We don't have to believe that all the sutras are the word of, you know what I'm saying? We don't have to buy any of that if we don't want to. But we do have to buy, because it's not yet our experience, that we are intrinsically Buddhas, whole and complete. And we simply do not recognize that. When we recognize that, then we are Buddhas. When we live from it, then we really have the capacity of benefiting people. That is the truth. Chris was going on yesterday about these views, or you know, we all have views, and I said, that's you were, there's nobody in this room that was born with views. I mean, does anybody here remember in their infancy having views? No. You know, and if you can't remember your own childhood, be around young children, you know? The views came after. The views were imposed on. On what? On a very pure mind. Don't forget, to distinguish between self and other and have views, we needed what? Language. And language was something that develops. And unfortunately, we take language as truth and not that which creates the language. Yes.
It seems to me that the hard wiring that people seem to feel is this urge to feel complete, to feel whole, to feel unified, which perhaps it's just ignorance. We've covered that up with conditioning, and we still have that urge, but through ignorance, we just keep trying to get more instead of realizing that the path to that is through getting rid of the obscurations. But it feels a little like, well, yeah, that hard wiring to have that completeness, maybe it's a common feeling, but there's just so much ignorance about how we come back. And
we discovered
that.
Yeah, that's everybody hear that. Again, I mean, I would say it a little differently. Angie was saying, you know, that all the things people do to distract themselves, to anesthetize themselves, to create happiness or well-being in themselves, all the endless activities that people do is because there is this missing of who and what we really are. There is a yearning for completion. There is a yearning to return home when we are, if we have had a, if home to us is a warm, loving place, right? Something that in our heart has a warm feeling to it. When we've been out in the cold or out in a difficult time, we yearn for home, don't we? And when we come home, we are happy. When we're not home, we miss it. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Everybody knows in this world something is missing. But they all run the wrong way, don't they? They run after things. They run after experiences. They accumulate, they run after power, they run after sex, they run after drugs, they run after alcohol, they run after acquisition, they run after relationships, they run after pleasure, they just endlessly run. And none of it gives them any kind of sustaining happiness or well-being. So they keep running from one thing to another, right? In our society, what? Every time you meet somebody, they'll tell you, well, this is what I'm into now. I used to be into that, but this is what I'm into now. Endlessly into things. Why is that? We're looking. We're searching. We're uneasy. We're dissatisfied. There's an unconscious sense there's something more. Something more somewhere. And we keep looking in the external world for the solution, rather than realizing, you know, it's because of our connection endlessly to the external world that we have lost our connection to our own intrinsic well-being. This retreat is called what? The Path to Wholeness. It's interesting. I was thinking about that because when I wrote that, it's interesting. You know, words relate to culture and time. You know, traditionally, in Buddhist time, it's often called the path to awakening, to a path to enlightenment. Right? These are words I think that resonate with the culture, time. But what struck me was in our time, because the sense of disconnection and separation is so powerful in our society, right? We have followed for several centuries now, or at least one or two, the path of disintegration. Our connection to family, our connection to neighborhood, to workplace, our connection to extended family, tribe, clan, you know, et cetera, has been broken. And more people are on their own, having to work things out for themselves. Find happiness themselves, not within the traditional societies, Asian societies, our own traditional societies, were much more, people were connected, they were part of. But we are very separate. And again, you know, currently it's just, you know, we have so many identifications, right? What's your name? How old are you? What race are you? What religion are you? What's your sexual orientation? You know what I'm saying? It's always like difference. You know, tell me how you're different. Tell me how you identify as different. Right. And we are so, we play so many roles. We have so many different faces that we, you know, that we don't, that we are, we don't feel integrated. We don't feel whole. There isn't that sense of wholeness in us. It's a feeling. We feel fragmented. We feel, you know, something's missing. We don't know what it is. So we endlessly are acting out in the world, trying to make the world give us what we're missing. Now, you have this radical teaching that actually doesn't say what Angie just said. In the teachings of Zen, in the teachings of Dzogchen or the Great Perfection, it doesn't say, as traditional Buddhism is often postulated, we are here deluded. We go through a process of purification, practice, and all that, so we can eventually what? Become a Buddha. Right? Can you see? It's a process. And Zen and Dzogchen, it says, no. We are right now Buddhas. We just don't recognize. Like water and ice. Hakuin says, right? What does that mean? Ice seems what? It's solid. It does, and ice can be made into all kinds of forms. Go to buffets, you know, you say, oh, make them beautiful. They can do all kinds of things with ice, right? Oh, well, you can make ice look anything, and it's solid. And yet, if you know that, no, in its essence, it is what? Water. It is water. You just apply a little heat to it, and you will see its essence, and it just flows, and it can become any form at all, any form it wants. We are frozen. We are frozen in our identities. We are frozen in our identifications. We're frozen because we talk about hardwired and belief and views, and we think they're real, and we think they're solid, and none of it is true. And if you believe that, and you act on that, you will find yourself in a very different life. I mean, I got into a little sparring match with my dear friend Charna this morning, who wanted to convince me what?
Deluded.
How deluded she was. And she was not given an inch. And then when I tried to kind of cut her off, she said, stop it. Let me finish. I want to make my case for my delusion. So I kind of gave her a couple of minutes, but I couldn't let it stand. You're an enlightened person who thinks she's deluded. That's all. Delusions are just what? Misperceptions. Right. When you know that's all they are, and you let them be, they can mind. As long as you think your perceptions are real and solid and true, and the self that believes in them is solid and all that, then you'll be lost in that world. But that battle or struggle between the enlightened and deluded, where is that playing out? In your own mind. It's not in some solid place. It's just going on in your own mind. A back and forth. You know what happens when you step into the tiger's cave? You may get scratched. But I encourage you to step in.
I've been there before. I want to say, in the interest of full disclosure, is that when you admittedly get into a conversation that you weren't a part of,
yes, I
party, mm-hmm. that I speak to this issue of taking things out of context. And because of,
well, I was just making a teaching point.
I agree.
It was for benefit. It wasn't personal.
It wasn't personal, but I think in the interest of getting to a deeper place, I want uh-huh. to clarify
good.
That I do believe that we have systems as our species that are hardwired, but at the same time, I believe that we all have an infinite capacity to change the software. And that the reason that I'm here at this intensive is because I'm interested in the transformation and the reprogramming of the software. I accept the hardware, and I think...
What is this hardware?
This hardware is we have a system within our skull that has actual... It is an actual organization of stuff. There is a stuff that's organized based on a plan that you and I had no control over.
And really? Who had control over it?
Well, that's another discussion. That's another.
So, in other words, there in ancient times, people believed there were gods who had control over us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you believe that it's like. You believe there is this thing called hardwiring that has control over us. And within that, we have certain limits to modify, but that basically our hardwiring, like the gods of ancient time, basically control us.
No, that's not what I'm saying. So I will clarify that.
Good.
There is a system that over millions of years has been organized as hardware.
And what does it do?
It functions.
Tell me how it functions right now. What is it doing right now?
It allows you to take vibrations that come into your ear, wiggle these little hairs, and create electrical impulses that go to your brain and tell you. That's what hearing does. Hearing is just picking up vibrations. Seeing is just your eyes are wavelength refractors. They just take.
And you think the way this has all been organized is not under our control.
The basic function of your seeing, the basic function of your hearing, is a function of millions of years of evolution. And within that, you have an infinite ability to create different software.
Can I ask you a question, Dr. Lerner? Saying that, does that bring you happiness?
No. But it brings me clarity.
What clarity didn't you have before?
Well, I had clarity, but I felt you were misrepresented.
Well, thank you.
Fred, there's some hands up over there.
Okay, yes. Yes.
So Epsilon the Brilliant, what Buddha's teaching us and what the lineage of teachers here in you today transmit. But I had another thought. What is actually Buddhism's stance on people who have a truly biochemical disorder that doesn't allow them to think that clearly and make such clear decisions on what thoughts giving up and what thoughts we keep? And we all may face this one day. Who knows what's out there, right? What's the stance of Buddhism?
Well, again, because Buddhism is not a kind of hierarchical, organized thing, you know, there's no such thing as Buddhism that has a stance on things like that. Okay, so I'm just saying that. If you're asking me, in the same way that we have a physical body, right, that is subject to all kinds of malfunctionings, that may need various kinds of interventions, in a certain way, the physicality of the brain and its functioning and the central nervous system is also subject to those types of things and could need interventions. Right? I mean, everything. You know, the problem with this body is what? Right? The problem with this body is it is impermanent. It is subject to dissolution. Right? That's the problem with it. And the same way our physicality and how it is just can affect the energy of the body and how it functions. In the same way, deformations and problems in the mind, in the brain and central nervous system, can also affect the functioning of the mind. Having said that, our true mind, our true unconditioned mind, is capable of interacting in an open and spacious way with anything and everything. That which fears and that which resists this deterioration of the body and mind is not the body, and it is not our true mind. It is what? It is the self that stands apart from the ongoing experience of our body-mind and says, I don't want this to happen. This shouldn't be happening. I'm afraid this is going to happen. What am I going to do if this happens? Right? I mean, all the things that we're worried about, most of them are things that go on in the body. They're physical, right? And yet the body isn't disturbed by it, is it? The body is quite capable of coexisting with all its problems, right? And in the truest sense, our mind, just as awareness, is too. What gets in the way is this self, this I, that wants things to be the way it wants it. I don't want to have a mind that can't remember. Can you see the imposition? But that is just, again, part of the deterioration of the body-mind, which is, it's just the way it is. It's nothing to be scared of. I used to joke with my father, who he actually died before it became significant, but he had Alzheimer's, early Alzheimer's. And he would say, he'd get all angry because, he couldn't remember anything. I say, Dad, people are practicing Zen and meditation and going to therapy so they can forget things. I mean, for you, it's coming naturally. Relax. Enjoy it. You're living in the moment, right? You can't create a past, you can't create a future, you're just in the present. This is wonderful, relax and enjoyment. I mean, are all these people out there working so hard to get where you are? He'd laugh. Yes, Barb.
Our resident doctor reminded me of something. Several years ago, I was working at Montreal Neurological Institute, and Dr. Penfield was working on Parkinson's disease. And so he has a person on the operating table, and he's putting a probe in, the person's awake, and finding the spot to freeze that would help with Parkinson's. And as he's going into the brain, he would touch cells, and a person would say, "Oh, I'm back in the kitchen with my mother," or I smell my favorite cookies. Or so what that said to me is there's some cellular memory. And so, I think what causes and conditions, there's some memory there. But what's so hopeful is through the new brain research about neuroplasticity, we can change. And so being here, I mean, I know I've changed in the last 2 years from the teachings and the readings and going to the Dharma and all that. And so, I feel really hopeful.
Good. Yeah, so, according to some other brain research showing the possibility, infinite possibility of change. We are what we are because of conditioning. We have been conditioned. If you had been switched out as an infant and given to a totally different family, different culture, you would probably grow up with very different values and ideas, etc. Doesn't mean you may not have some qualities that you would have had, that you inherited from your biological, but conditioning is very powerful. We know that. But to think that we are our conditioning is our fundamental mistake. Right? It is like if you are an actor and you've been given a role in a play and you've studied all your lines and you become the character and you, if you go over the line and you actually believe you are that character that you have been acting, then you have a problem with delusion, right? That is why we are considered by the Buddhas and the Masters deluded, because we identify with our roles as being us. Yes.
Can you address if a young child has been sexually abused for years and the body is reacting to the trauma? Let's say with a woman has sex or when she feels a certain way. It is almost unconscious for
Oh,
she did it's unconscious for that body.
Right.
He's not thinking.
Right. So body and mind are one, and like you say, the conditioning that goes on is also, you know, in the body and in the senses, because the experience was a full sensory experience. Right. Right. So again, those are extreme examples, but as you know, in our day and age, we are realizing for many segments of society, growing up with trauma and experiencing trauma is normal, right? It's not just soldiers in wartime, police, firemen. It's people who come up in all kinds of family situations, right? All kinds of abusive situations, alcoholic, I mean, it goes on and on. How the human body mind is traumatized. Traumatized really just means something extraordinary. Right, not ordinary, it's not unclear that kind of a negative traumatic experience may not be fairly ordinary, unfortunately, in our society. Again, my experience, having worked for many years with people like that, who've experienced that. It is, and again, I mean, I'm just speaking now from a Buddhist perspective, not necessarily a psychological perspective. That whole concept in Buddhism of, don't shoot the second arrow where there's already the first arrow. So for many people, the trauma, the actual experience, was significant. But as you're referring to, it has then been the person then identifies with that experience and it begins to deform their personality, the way they relate, the way their body is. And it can, and it just builds and builds and continues on for decades and decades. So we have this, it is almost like that becomes the real problem rather than the actual event, because we know. We know that this human body mind is capable of going through traumatic events and how they are dealt with, right? For example, and I've used this example before, when I was with Tibetan refugees in the 70s, I mean, these were people who what? Who were traumatized. They lost their homes, the Chinese killed them, they destroyed, they fought. I mean, they told you stories and stories and stories. They left. After all the fighting and the killing and the destruction and everything, and the leaving of Tibet and crossing the Himalayas and people being dying, they'd start out with hundreds and end up with three. And they come to India and they had nothing and they were, it goes on and on, all right? And yet, these people were not bitter. These people were not angry. These people did not it was amazing. They were Buddhists. So it shows you that the context, the way one relates to, because we... What am I... So it is important to understand both, and I'm just using an example of people, but as individuals, the way we relate to experience. What is experience? It is what is happening to us moment by moment. Right. I mean, that is where we practice. We practice in life, and things happen in life. We may call these good things, we may call these bad things, we may call these unwanted things, we may call these wanted things, but that's all our criteria. But that criteria changes how we relate to what's happening. In truth, all that's happening is things are happening. And two people or two peoples can be relating to the same type of experiences in very different way with very different results. We have to see the inherent freedom. I met people, monks, nuns, who were in jail, tortured for years in Chinese prisons. No anger, no resentment, no bitterness, right? You know, the opposite. Full of understanding and love and, you know. Well, how can that be? Right? Because you could meet, and we know, many people who've gone through the same experience in different kinds of prisons that come out broken, right? Destroyed. Right? So it is important to understand that for all of us, we cannot blame our minds on our circumstances. Right? Now again, if I was a therapist dealing with somebody traumatized, I would not say that to them.
You just gotta start thinking about that. You can't.
No, you can't. But again, that's because, I can say it here, because this is a group of people who are trying to understand more deeply. So obviously for people like that, you would help them the best way you can to be free. But those of us here, and it is helpful for us even in a context like that to have that deeper understanding, because when people like that have been significantly traumatized in that way, and again, everybody in this room to one degree or another has been traumatized a little bit, if not a lot, by life, right? I mean, nobody is here, unless you've had very fortunate karma, have just, everything's been wonderful. You know? I mean, that is rare. Most of us go through difficult circumstances with difficult people at difficult times. We understand not only love, but we understand hate. We not only stand being cherished, but we also understand being abandoned. You know what I mean? We understand kindness, and we understand cruelty. We understand wide level of human experience, right? And that is normal. So nobody, as I often say, gets through this life unscathed. So it is because of that that we practice. Right? It's because of that that we practice. And again, there are people within our own community and practice who have had those kinds of situations in their childhood of abuse. There are probably people here in this room, right, who have, in the course of their life, have come up against the cruelties of life, the way human beings can unfortunately treat one another, right? I mean, this is, we are not an extraordinary subset, right? We have to understand that. I'm sure if we all shared our stories here, we would find much in common. But the one thing that Buddhism gives us as a psychology is that it is our identification, right? Because one of the things you find with people who've come up in those kinds of circumstances, their perception of themselves is what? They are broken. They're bad. There's something wrong with them. And that's a self-perception. It's not real. All our thoughts about ourselves are just perceptions. They're not real. I can think I'm smart. I can think I'm stupid. Look, I can think it right after the other. I'm smart. I'm stupid. Right? I'm handsome. I'm ugly. Everybody loves me, everybody hates me. I mean, I can say anything. That is the danger of an out-of-control mind. It can perceive anything, it can think anything. That is why, as long as we are always listening to this mind, and its endless conversation that has been conditioned by historical conditions, we are lost. We will never change. When we understand that we have the essence of freedom within us, and The essence of freedom doesn't mean that we control everything. It means I am free. In the sense we're talking, let's say now, that even though such and such happened to me, and that was an experience, there was no me. No solid, permanent me. My connection from here to there is simply in the world of memory. It may live on in feelings in the body. It may live on in responses to current situations. But those can all be dealt with in the present when I am conscious. I once met this great Tibetan master, a wonderful being. And he talked about his early monkhood when he was a little monk. You know what they used to do to him? I mean, in those days, things were a little rough. And a lot of times, Tibetans would kind of give their young boys to the monastery. And they'd basically, to kind of be taught, you know, because there were no schools. So a lot of times they gave them just so they get an education. To be taught, they'd be given work. So they really sort of be like indentured slaves, but they learn, eventually work their way up. And I think he was like 6 years old, and his job, or 8 years old, he was young, was to go, go out with the yaks at night, the monastery's yaks, and kind of guide them around. And if he wasn't back on time, they would close the gates at night. And he would be left out all night. You know, wolves roaming around, you know, just alone, unprotected. And he told me this story, which somebody else could talk about as, what, one of the high traumatic points of their life. He laughed. Oh, it's the funniest thing. You know? He didn't think his the senior monks were torturers or cruel. It was just the way things were, and wasn't it funny? And the wolves were roaming around, and he'd hear them. And, ha, ha, ha. So what does that tell you? To hear these stories shows us that there is another way. Again, we are so self-identified. Everything that happens, we relate it to me. I want to do just a little teaching this morning. I mean, I don't know what I've been doing up to now. Bodhidharma. Basically, and we'll probably be starting tomorrow, I want to begin by teaching a great early Chinese Zen poem called The Song of the Grass Hut. It's quite wonderful. This is from Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, everybody know Bodhidharma? Bodhidharma was considered the founder of what in Japan was called Zen. In China, it was called Chan. Bodhidharma was Indian. We're talking like around the 6th century. He was Indian. And he came from India, where he was a great student of Dharma. He came to China, and he stayed there many years, then left. And all the lineages of Chan and then Zen go back to Bodhidharma. And there's very little teaching ascribed to him. In this book, they refer to, this book is called Zen's Chinese Heritage. They refer to Bodhidharma, and for about 6-7 generations after him, they call that the legendary period of Zen. It was sort of kind of before things got written down and codified. And it's unclear how much is legend and how much is real. There is a sense there probably was somebody, but they were different times. The noble enter the way, way, capital W, the way of awakening, the way, the Tao. But essentially, there are two of which I speak. One is by principle and one is by practice. Those who enter by principle avail themselves to the teaching of the enlightened doctrine that all, I'm reading this to you so you understand that I'm not making this up. Alex. Greater minds than myself. Long before people talked about hardwiring and... I mean, Alex, you know, how long have people been talking about hardwiring and software?
A long time.
How long?
Oh, less than the Buddhist tradition.
Much less than the Buddhist tradition, Alex? How long do you think?
You know, since the age of computers we talk about.
And how long has that been, Alex?
Let's just say 30 years.
All right.
You're really trying to nail me.
Well, forgive me. I know you're a little ill, and I'm taking advantage of you in your weakened condition. Good. Wear them proudly. So there are two ways to, there are two paths to enter the way. One is by principle and one is by practice. Those who enter by principle avail themselves to the teachings of the enlightened doctrine that all beings, please understand that when he says all beings, he means you. Don't go abstract. All beings means you. All beings possess the same true nature, like water and ice. We might say everybody in this room has been formed into a different kind of ice cube, right? Is that clear? But we are all composed of the same nature. It is water. All beings possess the same true nature, though it is obscured and not apparent due to worldly attachments and delusion. Okay? It is not apparent. Apparent means we don't see it. Why don't we see it? Right? If that is our nature. Because of our attachments and our delusions. Our attachments and delusions are all about the things we've been talking about who and what I really am, all the things I identify with, all the things that I think will give me happiness and meaning and purpose that I run after. If you watch your mind during retreat, you will see what your mind is up to. Many people find it overwhelming. Many people find their minds disappointing. Right? When they stop and they just be, but it's not like that. You want to see that. Oh. Because you will see how the mind is always running after something, always grasping, always has a view about this, an idea about that, a desire for this, a dislike of that, an opinion about this, a need for that, a desire for, right? It's endless, you know, oh, no wonder I cannot see what is right before my eyes. Because of my attachments and my delusions. Delusions are false ideas. If one forsakes delusion and returns to the true, fixing one gaze on a wall, and Bodhidharma is known for what is called wall gazing. Supposedly, he just, after a couple of experiences with the Chinese people, he kind of felt these people are not ready for what I have to give them. He retired to Shaolin Mountain and lived in a cave, where he supposedly just faced the wall and meditated. So it's called wall gazing. Fixing one's gaze on a wall and forsaking thoughts of self and other. How many of us in our meditation, it means a meditation we're doing, do we forsake thoughts of self and other? Please watch your minds and see how many of your thoughts are about yourself or about others. You may be surprised. If you knew that it is that very endless involvement in thoughts of self and other that is preventing you from seeing the way things really are and experiencing life directly, you may forsake them. Fixing one's gaze on a wall and forsaking thoughts of self and other, sacred and profane, and so on. That's a long and so on. It means all thoughts of duality, all the opinions you have, even about things like hardware and software. Right? Just give it up. And then by not moving and not chasing after scriptures or teachings. Right? So you can see how radical he was. What is he saying? That the essence of this practice comes from understanding your own mind. And at a certain point, chasing after scriptures, chasing after teachings, is just another kind of activity. By not moving in and not chasing after scriptures or teachings, one is in accord with the principle. When one undertakes silent, non-discriminating, non-action, it is called entering the way through principle. And then he goes on about talking about the way of practice. What four types of practice are these? The first is enduring the results of past action. The second is the practice of acting according to conditions. The third is practice is seeking nothing. And the fourth is known as practicing the Dharma. So we can see there is a basis, going back to Bodhidharma himself, who brought these teachings from India, from the Buddhist tradition, meditative tradition that had developed in India, that at a certain point in one's development, human development, psychological development, spiritual development, the most important thing that one can do is simply to look into one's own mind. The most important thing you can do is look into your own mind. If you ask me, what is my mind? I would say, that which is listening to me right now. That is your mind. Do you know it? To know it means, have you turned around and actually looked at it? What is my mind? What is a mind? What is a self? What is a thought? What is a feeling? Where do thoughts come from? Where do emotions come from? Can I see the software and the hardwiring? You know, to really go, what am I talking about? We use language, we use concepts, but what do they really mean? They have to mean something because there's somebody who's saying them. Who's saying them, right? As Charna was going on about her delusions this morning, I said, Charna, Who's telling me about your delusive self? There must be obviously somebody very wise inside you who can tell that the other one is delusion. Tell me about her. Right? You know? What are these things that go on in our mind that we don't look deeply at? The Buddha became the Buddha because he looked into his own mind. There is an innate wisdom that each and everybody here has. That when you realize your true mind, it has an innate wisdom that understands things quite deeply. And that is much deeper than thinking. There is a deeper wisdom than the thinking mind. So we practice mindfulness and concentration to quiet, calm the mind. Mindfulness and concentration also have a very nice side benefit. It helps us touch life more intimately, more deeply. So it definitely improves the quality of our experience. Because we're no longer experiencing life through our thoughts, or not experiencing life at all because we're so lost in thoughts. We're able to experience people, situations, ourselves directly. So mindfulness and concentration are the foundation for this path. And that is why we cultivate this. But it is through this investigation, this deep looking into, that we enter the world of liberation. Because now we understand. We understand that these views that we have, these ideas that we have no substance, have no intrinsic reality, are biased, are arising because of cause and conditions. They're really not even our thoughts. If we'd grown up in a different family, in a different culture, different situation, we wouldn't have these kind of thoughts. We'd have another whole set of thoughts. And if we were as egotistical as we are now, we'd be as strong as those. Right? We'd just be, you know, we'd just be on the other side. So we have to look deeply into these views, these ideas, these thoughts, and this self that holds it all as belonging to me. That is our practice. And as Bodhidharma says, we have to be willing put down our endless involvement in ourselves and others. You know, look at the content of your thought. Watch your minds. You'll see it's endlessly going on about itself or about others. And that is obscuring. That is the fog that prevents us from seeing clearly the reality that's really right here. Any questions about how to practice? I mean, if you're not clear, please ask a question. Yes?
Yeah, I did have a question. When you told the story about the monk who was, young monk who was left out with the wolves, most people would have had a spontaneous emotion come up. Does Buddhism talk about spontaneous emotions? Are they also part of our conditioning, or do they come with, like sadness, anger, fear.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're asking, you know, yeah, there is there, you're saying, is it all conditioning or there is just some aspect? There obviously that we all are aware of some, you know, there is something, a commonality to the human condition, that the basic feelings of sadness or anger or fear, happiness, seem to be present in most human beings throughout time and history. So there's obviously, some basic conditioning of the mind and the body that is common to all of us. Again, the problem is most of us don't have a very pure emotional life, because our emotional life is contaminated by self. Right? In other words, it is one thing to be afraid when the wolves are prowling about, right? But when we start hating the people who have put us there, when we start feeling sad and lonely, that is not because of the wolves, is it? That is because of a story, we might say, that we are telling ourselves about the situation. And that often takes on the historical life long after the wolves are gone. We are still holding on to that story of she did this to me, and decades later. And so, you know, that is a very different thing than a pure emotion. That is what one might call a self-created emotion. And that we have full control over. Yes.
How do we differentiate delusion from truth?
How would you do it? The question is, how do you differentiate delusion from truth? A delusion is what?
Well, delusion is something that we create. It's a view. It's a choice.
Well, it's a false view.
It's a false view.
I mean, if someone's deluded, they're believing, they have an idea about something that is untrue.
Right.
Right? So if you said, hi, my name is Dora, and I am a man, we would say Dora, and she really believed it, we'd say, Dora, that is a delusion. Right? Right. And if we said, hi, I am Dora, I am a woman, we would say, in reality, she is not deluded. She's speaking the truth.
But let's say somebody like Fred decided that it would be a good thing for there to be a Dharma center on Nebraska.
Well, he would be deluded. But sometimes, you know, delusions manifest in intra-epical. Yes.
At that level, when we're making choices, how do we trust the foundation?
Well, hold on, that's a...
which we make our big choices. Mm-hmm. How do we know they're not, how do we really know they're not based on the layers of delusion, the cause and effect, the views, all of that?
Yeah, well, I would say, the simple way, my first response would be the less and less and less your mind is filled with delusions, ideas, the more empty your mind is, the more present you are to reality. I think intuitively we often know, and we never know absolutely, right? There is a knowing that this is the thing to do. And that is always then tested by reality, right? So reality is the final test. But between that and a delusion, there's a big gulf, right? If one has an idea that a Dharma center can be established on Nebraska, and it has a good firm basis in real situations, people, abilities, play, lots of variables, then it will manifest. if it's a total disaster, one would say that the idea that one could do something like that there at this moment is not true. So, I mean, one never knows. But I would say the more one is acting from wisdom, from seeing clearly, and that one's view is not distorted by one's own needs or wants or egoistic kind of grandiosities, or you know what I'm saying? I think there's less chance that delusion will reign. But at the end of the day, we're always testing reality. And this Buddha mind interacts with reality quite freely, quite openly. Right? You know, this mind is always encountering what? Phenomena, right? Our minds, right? Our minds, our awareness, are always encountering experiences. That's what it does. And it has the capacity of freely interacting with experiences and events. And the more that our mind is, not deluded. That's all I can say. It's not deluded. It's not filled with misperceptions. It's not filled with wrong ideas. It's not filled with itself. That's the big one to get out of the way. It's as Bodhidharma said, you know, are we willing to give up, you know, all our attachments, all our aversions, all our delusions, self-created, and live in reality of the way things are? And that's very free. Because at the end of the day, whether there's a Dharma center on Nebraska or not, you know, the big picture doesn't really matter, does it? Even if we did our best and it was a failure, good may come out of that, right? So hopefully, whatever the outcome is, our hearts are pure and our desire is always filled with good intentions. Right? I mean, it's just life unfolding. That's all that's going on here. Just life unfolds, right? I mean, we've been sitting here for an hour and a half, you know, just unfolding with each other. You know, it's all gone. Right? It's all gone. Every word that was spoken, every idea you've had, every response, it's all gone. None of it's real in any solid way, right? That doesn't mean we haven't had a meaningful good time together. But it is empty. It's an empty experience. Empty of solidity. That's really the way it is. And even if you hold it in your memory, that's just a memory. And that's good. That's what life's about, isn't it? It just unfolds. And this mind is aware of its unfolding and just responds. Yes.
So when I'm practicing, I start by using mindfulness to quiet my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I'm doing that, I will find that my thoughts will continue to race. And what I've been doing is just going to what you've talked about before, the lion and the rock. I start looking at the source of that. I don't always successfully get my mind to quiet down before I start looking at where those thoughts are coming from. Is that a wise way to practice, or should I keep trying to calm my mind?
No, you should never try to calm your mind. He's saying, if your mind is racing, should you calm it, or should you look at the source of it, or what should you do? And I'm saying you should never try to calm down your mind. You are forcing things. You are manipulating. Right? Stop feeding it. Right? Racing thoughts. Just saying that, racing thoughts, is an acknowledgement of what? That there are lots of thoughts moving around in your mind. I mean, you know, I was sitting out here yesterday and there were racing boats going up the river. I was sitting there quite calmly. Boat, boat, you know, they're doing this thing and there's some guy out there yelling at them, you know, giving all kinds of instruction. I mean, you know. I was very relaxed, at ease. Why was that?
You're just letting it unfold.
Letting it unfold, not identifying with it, just letting it be. Your problem is what? You look at that racing mind and you go what?
I want to grab it.
Yeah, I don't like this. I don't want to have this, right? I got to get rid of this. Yeah, that's, you know, I could have been sitting out there going, damn it. Right, I want to sit out here in peace and quiet, right? And look at these idiots going up and down. They've ruined my meditation, ruined my day, you know. Should be a logger, right? Like that. It's your choice. You know, do you want to suffer? Or do you want to be at ease and at peace? Let your mind be. It is what it is. And you relax. Stop judging. Stop judging your mind and stop wanting to be different than it is. You are who you are. It is what it is. Just relax and open. It'll quiet down. It'll quiet down. Thank you. Yes, and then we got to end. Yes.
So you pointed the way towards resting in this Buddha mind or true mind as opposed to this deluded self and looking into what's the you know, what are delusions, are they real, looking at the content of our mind to see is it about us or other people. But perhaps there's too much freedom for creativity and practice going forward. Maybe you could to narrow in, so like when we go outside, say for walking meditation, what should we be doing to help us to experientialize this teaching?
So when you are doing walking meditation outside or in solitary practice, you are practicing mindfulness, concentration, and deep looking. Okay, what does that mean? That means you're beginning with being aware, relaxed awareness of the walking, the situation you're in, the nature. You're relaxed and open. You're practicing mindfulness, right? And the mind is unified, relaxed, and open. But as Chris has pointed out, that is situational. We want to use this openness not to just have a good experience, not to just have a little vacation, but to look deeply. So we might stop and sit down, right? And begin to ask ourselves, what? Who is it that's walking? What is walking? Let's say you're enjoying it. Who is it that's enjoying it? Is it my body that's enjoying the walking? Right? Is it my mind that's enjoying the walking? Is it somebody named Brian who's enjoying the walking? And whatever you say, then look for that. See if there's really something there called a mind, a Brian, a walker, a hearer, a looker. You want to get into the heart of it. Right? So if Chris is disturbed by his thoughts, what is it that's disturbed by thoughts? Is your body disturbed by having thoughts? Is your mind disturbed by having thoughts?
No, so I haven't.
Well, whatever. So what is it that's all bothered by having lots of thoughts? And you would say what? Well, you would probably first say Chris or me. And I would say, all right, do you know that which you're calling Chris? And you would say, I don't know. So you are having an emotional response to thoughts based on somebody's response who you don't know. Right?
Yes.
And yet you're following their every word, beck and call. All right. But so you're not going to be satisfied. Where does this Chris dwell? Well, you need to go look for him. You can't just, right? Right? There's an ant biting you. Right? If, I don't know is a good answer, but the ant's still biting you. You got to go look for it. Now, where do you think this Chris may dwell?
In my mind, in my head.
Good. Well, so look there. What do you see? Look for that which doesn't like having thoughts. Gets all bothered by having lots of thoughts. What do you see when you look into your mind? Do you see him?
No.
What do you see? Look right now. What do you see?
Nothing.
Nothing. What is that nothing like? Is it really a nothing? What is it?
I have no idea how to say it. It's just empty. Yeah.
How does it feel?
Quiet.
It's quiet. Is it closed or open?
It's open.
Is it relaxed or is it uptight?
It's relaxed.
Yeah, it's open, relaxed, at ease. Oh. Well, that's interesting. Right? Your problem is where are you always looking? At the thoughts. And you're all busy, 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 busy. And you think that's you, and that's reality. But you look the other way, and what do you see? Things are at ease. That's you, Chris. Who would have thought? Right? That if you look the other way, things are open, spacious, relaxed, at ease. There's nothing there. How wonderful. Why don't you just relax into that?
Okay.
Try that for a couple of decades. You might enjoy that better.
Yes.
Is that clear?
Yes.
But you have to do it over and over again, because 2 minutes from now, your old nonsense will just kind of be up there. And if you're not, just, oh, where is that? What is that? What is that self, that voice, telling me, oh, this is terrible. I've got to stop these thoughts. They're just thoughts. They're nothing. Right? Those things going up and down were just things appearing to my eyes. That's all they were. Sounds appearing to my ears. That's the truth. That's all that was going on. Sounds and sights. Let them be. Enjoy them. But it's, if you want to get rid of it, it's because you're attached to them. You're grasping at that phenomena. People can't even go up and down the complete strangers can't even row up and down the river without us thinking about them. Should be here, shouldn't be here, like it, don't like it. That's the self endlessly doing that nonsense. And we suffer because of that. That's a little one, but we do it big. So please, is that...
That's up.
So good, we will stop.